Tommy Lorenzo.
And this is the Pop Style Opinion Fest. Hello, kittens. Welcome back to another edition of the PSO. I am the T in your T-Lo, Tom Fitzgerald. And I'm here with the Low in your T-Lo, Lorenzo Marquez, my lovely husband.
Hello.
How are you doing, Lorenzo?
I'm fine.
You're a liar.
I don't know. I'm getting a little antsy.
We all have our weeks where that we hit the wall, you know, yeah, and then the next week you're fine. And
some
then
days are better than others.
Yeah, yeah, this was a hit the wall kind of week for us. We talked about this a little bit on our site, isn't that this week has been the least productive week of our year in terms of content because, you know, we're on month three of a lockdown where in which no pop culture is being produced, no fashion is being produced, and we're also 2 weeks into the biggest social upheaval in America, probably in my lifetime, which is the ongoing Black Lives Matter protests that are going on in response to George Floyd's murder, Breonna Taylor's murder, and a bunch of other murders, which naturally kind of puts a pause on a site like ours. There's only so much material that you can generate at a time when people just don't. Oh my God, the cats are going crazy right now.
It never fails. As soon as we set up, equipment,
Miss Mew is right behind us,
and everything, they go nuts. They start
because
like
to
eating,
be perfectly honest,
water.
It's very weird when we start recording this podcast. The whole thing gets very weird. Like, why are you sitting down at the dining room table yelling at each other? Because you have to speak loudly to speak into the mic.
They don't understand. And they gather around.
They gather around to watch. What are you doing? What is this?
And then they suddenly remember that they have to drink water. They have to eat.
Right, they have to eat.
Make
right
noise.
Now, Miss Mew Mew is directly behind my chair going completely nuts on a scratching pad, which we should have removed the scratching pad from the dining room.
I know, but she'll stop at some point, hopefully. Anyway,
crazy bitch.
So
anyway.
Yeah, it's hard to find content, number one, and then at the same time you have to be.
It's hard to assess whether you should be posting content.
Right, you have to be aware, socially aware, and you know it's complicated and.
And it's also, you know, we've talked about this. In fact, we've talked about it a lot in the past several podcasts. So I apologize if we're repeating ourselves, but there is this matter of knowing your lane. Which doesn't mean we shouldn't talk about the things that are going on right now, the social issues and the race issues that are being discussed right now, in the same way that we talked about Me Too when it was going on. The difference is when Me Too exploded, it exploded right in the middle of award season, which was a prime opportunity for us to discuss these things, and there were protests on red carpets and stuff like that. But what's happening right now is happening with no other pop culture going on. So there is very little intersection between pop culture or fashion and all the protesting
right.
that's going
now,
on.
Now, imagine all this happening, and as at the same time you have a red carpet thing going on. You'd see a lot more African-American actors, you know, speaking on the red carpet and saying something and wearing interesting things just to be visually interesting and so that everyone is focused on them.
Right, I mean, right, right.
That all helps a lot.
But none of that's going on.
No,
and
none of them, yeah.
This is a good segue into what we're going to be talking about this week. It's the ways in which again, this is almost a repeat of last week's topic, but goodness, more and more examples keep popping up in the ways in which celebrities and corporations and editors are failing to meet this moment. And my take, we'll talk about some specific examples, but my overriding take is that these systems are so large and or so insulated. And I mean things like corporate media systems and major publishing companies. And basically the entire celebrity complex system is so insulated from reality that it's impossible for them to grapple with these issues in a way that feels effective or doesn't feel performative. So this week, a bunch of celebrities got together to shoot another very earnest hostage video. I can't even remember what it was called. Oh yeah, hashtag take responsibility. Now, and it was, you know, Kristen Bell and Sarah Paulson and Julianne Moore and just a bunch of them. Kesha was in it. Aaron Paul was in it. what the hell is his name? Justin Theroux was in it. Stanley Tucci was in it. And it was universally reviled the second it dropped. Everybody just was like, no celebrities. This is not it.
The thing is, this one is worse than the Imagine one.
Well, the Imagine one, they were just trying to cheer everybody up because of the virus.
But this was so calculated and planned with a black and white video.
Everybody's dressed in black t-shirts and no one's wearing any makeup.
And it's all shot in black and white.
And it's so, like, signaling earnestness. Now, I have to say... you can't talk about this without referencing the fact that the video and the Take Responsibility campaign was put together by the NAACP. So, which is not my way of saying, well, blame them that this didn't go wrong. It's just there's nuance there. It's sort of like when the members of Congress came out this week with their police reform bill, and they all wore kente cloth stoles and knelt on the floor of Congress and everything. And it wasn't as reviled as the celebrity thing, but it was questioned. It raised a lot of eyebrows. And again, you know, it was a lot of Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer on the news wearing kente cloths, which opens up to a lot of, you know, that visual right there opens up to a lot of...
discussion.
Criticism, because it looks like performative white allyship. Again, though,
and it does if you look at the stoles handed out,
and these were in reference to these kente stoles are worn by graduates of HBCUs. That's where the tradition comes from. And they were handed out by members of the Congressional Black Caucus. They were asked to wear these by members of the Congressional Black Caucus, just like all these white celebrities were asked to do this video by the NAACP. So again, this is not meant to blame, you know, oh, it's black people's fault or anything. It's just to point out that these, it's so clear that these incidences are difficult for everybody involved to figure out a way. Right. Like, how do celebrities talk or become involved in this enormous social issue without looking like they're performing?
The thing is that it comes down to people with a lot of money in a huge house, bored, and then they feel they're not getting attention, enough attention. So they feel like they need to be out there. They need to speak. And they do it in a way that it's kind of clueless.
I mean, I feel like they do need to. They can't, no, like, they we have felt to. The pressure to address, so they, why shouldn't Julianne Moore, you know?
They need to, but they're so unaware of how they come across.
The thing about the video was that, one of the things we said on Twitter was, like, the sentiments being expressed in the video, which were all about white people taking responsibility for the things that they don't challenge when other white people talk a certain way, or the jokes that they don't, you know, that they allow people to say. It's all that stuff. It's all about how white people need to take responsibility for allowing sort of racism to swirl around them unchallenged. That's absolutely a correct sentiment to have, but the point is you don't do this by staring into your phone and clutching your chest and earnestly apologizing. No. You do it by calling out other white people. So I understand it's an educational campaign to get white people to understand that they need to constantly question things that they take for granted, and they need to take responsibility when they let those things go by unchallenged. There's nothing wrong with the message, but the way it was done.
Well, it's the way it's done. I mean, first of all, it looked like a Calvin Klein underwear campaign.
It totally did.
You say
like
a line.
Like a perfume ad.
And
it looked
somebody
like a perfume ad.
Finish your line, and then dramatic looks, and then Aaron Paul, like,
that jackass,
ready to kill someone.
He was going for an Emmy on that one.
It's just crazy. It's crazy, and it's just embarrassing. I prefer if you... Where's your money? I'd prefer if you donated some money to to anything.
Open your purses.
Yeah, and I'm sure a lot of them are doing that, but why don't you do that? Do a video about you doing that and encouraging people to do it or something.
I can't look at Aaron Paul. This is an aside. I can't look at Aaron Paul without thinking of something, a comment I read about him this past season of Westworld, because he was on this past season and it wasn't a very good season. And it was a comment, I don't think it was on any of our reviews. It was on probably an AV Club review where someone said, Aaron Paul has two facial expressions. What the fuck is going on? And what the fuck is going on, bitch? And that's it. That's all he could do. And that's basically was what was on display in this video. He was trying so hard to be like earnestly, seriously white and outraged. And it just, it was so performative.
I mean, it is like, you know, and they always the glasses to show that you're serious.
I don't have mascara glasses on, and I'm wearing my glasses.
It's just like, come on, those are
fight racism.
Yeah, done a million times and criticized a million times. So hello, you don't have a PR person, someone to say, guys,
here's the thing though, if the NAACP calls and says we'd like you to do a video about racism,
yes,
I can't blame any of those people for saying yes.
But then you'd say, can we talk about how we're doing this?
Right.
Yes. I mean, listen, we are far from being celebrities or famous or anything like that. But we have learned after many years that when we are interviewed by magazines or newspapers or anything, we've in the past, I'm going to just be very honest here. In the beginning, we'd just say, sure, yeah, we're doing it.
Right, right, right.
We were not prepared. We didn't know what we're going to say, what was going to be asked. Nothing. And we were always caught in a situation where we're like, oh my God. But then now, with a lot more experience, every time someone calls us for a soundbite or something, we always say, okay, what do you need? And what is this for? You ask questions.
Right. Otherwise, it's a waste of your time.
Not just a waste of your time, but then you
call. Oh, right. There was that one time we...
Yeah, but anyway...
I won't even get into that.
But my point is that you need... You need to make sure...
A journalist was not open with us about why she was interviewing with
us.
And then wound up using a quote out of context to make it sound like we were saying something we were not.
But my point is that if your voice, literally, is going to be used, you need to make sure that it represents how you feel about something. You can't just say, yes, we're going
to
do it.
And you have to be clear. You have to have a clear understanding of what the outcome... What is this going to look like on the other end?
Right.
What is this, the finished product, going to be? Because... Again, on paper, I'm sure this all sounded really great to them, and obviously the intentions were good, and the sentiments being expressed were correct, but the whole style of the thing was so awful. And I tend to think it's more down to whoever directed this thing than individual... I mean, granted, Aaron Paul could have stepped it back
just a little bit.
And the other thing was, which was really insulting, was that so many of them were clearly reading off of their phones. And, you know, as so many people pointed out, you had like maybe two lines. You couldn't pay the respect of memorizing the lines instead of making it so obvious that you're reading them.
Well, they connected the lines. So
you could have memorized them.
Maybe they had to read the whole thing because that's how it works. You have to read the whole thing and then
that's one of their primary skills is memorizing huge blocks of text.
Just say it, you know, but it the black and white thing and looking like you just
no makeup
off,
and
it
they
doesn't
were literally
help.
Like clutching their chest.
It doesn't help people. It doesn't help. It doesn't make you more concerned just because how visually concern you are.
I mean, this is something we all have to wrestle with, white people who are listening to this. We all have to wrestle with our allyship and whether it's effective or whether it's just there to make us look good or feel good. And these two examples of the representatives wearing the kente cloth and the celebrities taking off all their makeup to cry into their phones, what are you doing? Like, what is the end result of this? What is the actionable? How is this helping? Is this really helping? Or is this bringing more attention on you than onto the actual issues being discussed? Like, how many people who made fun of Nancy Pelosi's kente cloth knows anything about what that bill introduced about police brutality? Nobody knows because it got completely overshadowed by a bad picture.
Mm-hmm.
And as I keep returning to, this Take Responsibility initiative is absolutely correct, but nobody can see that because the message was packaged so badly that it just became a joke. And I think things like this, the reactions of things like this can be a little bit scary to white people because you look at it and you're like, well, they were trying and everybody wound up making fun of them. Maybe I shouldn't, blah, blah, blah. And, well, you know, suck it up, buttercup. It's hard. That's the whole point. All of these conversations, all of these things that we're doing and talking about right now are difficult for everybody, but white people are having difficulty wrestling with these concepts. Not that I'm saying you should feel sorry for us, just that if you're feeling too confused or too scared to speak up, I'm afraid that, in my opinion, that's not a good enough reason not to. I would give all of the people in that video credit for, you tried something. It was a shitty thing. It looked stupid, and you all wound up looking like jackasses. But I won't take away that you did try to do something. Same thing with, like, Nancy and Chuck wearing their kente cloths. It's like, I get it. I won't take that away from you. And for I can't speak as a white person as to whether or not this was actually effective. Although all I saw from black writers and journalists and commenters was that it was not effective and they didn't like it.
It was very staged. That's the problem. I mean, if you have to sound and come across as sincere.
Right.
If you don't, then you failed.
Right.
That's the bottom line here.
That is the bottom line. And I think one of the things I want to get into is... one of the things I want to get into that leads after this is how the corporate response kind of fumbled it this week. And I'm specifically talking about HBO Max and their decision regarding Gone with the Wind, which kind of blew up in their faces. But before we do that, we want to talk about our Raycon earbuds. Lorenzo has been working out. We've been really stepping up our home workouts this week. And thank goodness for those earbuds, because we can work out and not bother the other person, which under the current conditions, that is very much needed. Whether you're working from home or working on your fitness, you want what you're listening to be what you're listening to, not what your spouse, roommates, neighbors, or children are listening to. Everyone needs a great pair of wireless earbuds, but before you go dropping hundreds of dollars on a pair, you need to check out the wireless earbuds from Raycon. You already know Raycon earbuds start at about half the price of what any other premium wireless earbuds on the market, and that they sound just as amazing as other top audio brands you know. Their newest model, the Everyday E25 earbuds, are their best ones yet, with 6 hours of playtime, seamless Bluetooth pairing, more bass, and a more compact design that gives you a nice noise-isolating fit.
They are absolutely perfect. Let me tell you, I can't work out without music. I have to listen to music. The pumping has to be going on while I'm working out. They are perfect. Perfect because they're cordless. So, you don't have to worry about, having the weight,
They're so comfortable and well-designed, too.
They are perfectly designed. They're smaller than...
sound is perfect.
The sound flawless. Quality is amazing. It's just great. I've had many different brands and far more expensive, and I honestly say they are the best in terms of sound, quality, everything.
Raycon's wireless earbuds are so comfortable, perfect for conference calls or binging podcasts. Unlike some of your other wireless options, Raycon earbuds are both stylish and discreet, with no dangling wires or stems to distract anyone during video calls. You might have heard us talk about how the company was co-founded by Ray J, and celebrities like Snoop Dogg, Cardi B, Melissa Etheridge, and Brandy are obsessed with their Raycons. So pick up a pair and see what the hype is about. Now's the time to get the latest and greatest from Raycon. Get 15% off your order at buyraycon.com/TLO. That's buyraycon.com/TLO for 15% off. Raycon wireless earbuds. buyraycon.com/TLO. Thank you, Raycon. Okay, back to everyone screwing it up this week. HBO Max, a new streaming service from HBO that nobody knows how to get on their TV, made this announcement this week that they were going to... Now, I should backtrack. John Ridley, the African-American film director, published a editorial in the Los Angeles Times, basically urging platforms to reconsider hosting Gone with the Wind at this moment. He wasn't talking about putting it in a vault and never airing it again, but just at the time, this is not the right time for blah, blah, blah.
Why that is specific? Why that movie
I don't know. It's long been a, So HBO Max, we'll get into it. HBO Max, which just launched and has Gone with the Wind on its platform, made this very showy announcement that they were going to take it off their platform, which was meant, of course, in these times, with partisan outcry and screaming and yelling about American heritage and we're destroying blah, blah, blah. And, people think if you take Gone with the Wind off a streaming platform for a couple of weeks, it's the same thing as tearing down a statue of Winston Churchill, and it's kind of not. Anyway... HBO Max came back because they kind of fumbled the announcement and said that it would be coming back to the service, but that they would be adding sort of like an introduction to explain the, you know, the racial issues with the film.
Right.
Now, I I'm going to step on some people. I never liked the movie. I never liked it.
I know you.
And I love old films. Yes. It's not that I can't. I love old films. And when as I said a couple nights ago, this movie is on TCM every 6 weeks. People can watch it anytime they want.
Right.
And we have caught it in I've walked past the TV with it on because Lorenzo leaves TCM on for like hours. And I'll sit and watch maybe 20 minutes of it at a time. And I'm like, yeah, no, this still hasn't held up for me. I don't mind the films that are very stylized in their acting, like old films where, you know, lines are delivered in a very stylized way and camera movements and all that sort of, you know, everything about it is quaint and stylized. That's not what bothers me about Gone with the Wind. We'll get into the racist aspect of it, but as a film, I never thought it was great American filmmaking. It's big American filmmaking. It's studio filmmaking at its finest when they could devote all the money into the spectacle of it and get the very, you know, the most famous, most beautiful, most charismatic stars to mm-hmm. star in it. And it has all of that, like an amazing cast, all of whom are in their own way great in it. I mean, I really am not going to take away from Vivien Leigh's portrayal of Scarlett O'Hara. It is legendary. And with good reason. And I certainly am not going to take away from Hattie McDaniel, who played, I guess her name was Mammy, right? In the film?
Remember.
I can't remember. She played the maid. And she won an Oscar for it. She was the first African-American to win an Oscar. It was a historic thing. So, you know, there are reasons to uphold the film as an American classic, and it is certainly well-beloved. But in terms of its... The film, if you're just looking at it and looking at it from a critical eye, it's okay. It's just really big. It's really beautiful. It's got a huge spectacle to it, and you can't take away from the charisma of its main stars. You just can't take away from Clark Gable and Vivien Leigh. 80 years later, they had it. I understand all of that, but it's the story is all over the place. And from a historical perspective, it just forgives way too much of the antebellum South and just sort of glosses over the horrors of slavery. Any portrayal of the antebellum South that, like when you look at the opening scenes of the film at Tara, they're beautiful, but my God, they're so romanticized. Everything is so clean. Everybody is so beautiful and refined and they have all their teeth and they all have good skin. And
It's a product of the time, of how movies were made at the time. They didn't take any of the historical or racial issues into consideration. They just made a movie... perfectly fit for the time.
And, you know, you should remember that we are further away from the release date of Gone with the Wind than the release date of Gone with the Wind was from the actual Civil War. I mean, only what? 74 years separate Gone with the Wind and the end of the Civil War. But it's been 81 years for us. So they were so close to those events. I just read this week, Hattie McDaniel's parents were slaves.
Oh my God.
Her father fought in the Civil War.
I didn't know that.
So you, of course, the way it presented that history was not going to be the way we understand it now because it was just way too close to it. And, you know, it was operating in a system of white supremacy that was not going to allow a portrayal of slavery to be realistic. Just a quick example. One of the things that struck me as about 12 Years a Slave was that it completely deromanticized the plantation. If you go look at those plantations, where you can go and have weddings now today, they weren't these huge romantic Disney castles. That's not what it was. They were farms with a great house.
Yeah,
and they were dirty. And they basically had slaves living on their front lawn. 12 Years a Slave was really good about that, about showing you, you know, if you have slave cabins on your estate, it's not some fine estate. It's not, you know, you can't romanticize that. It wasn't all Monticello, you know what I mean? It wasn't all, and it was certainly wasn't all Tara. The plantation system was obviously exploitive and dirty and nasty and horrible. So any attempts to romanticize it just don't age well. They just don't age well. But people love this movie. The mystique surrounding this movie is, in some ways, Gone with the Wind is as much a part of American culture as the Civil War itself.
Oh, wow.
Am I wrong?
No, I agree, because it made me read the book.
Which is way more racist than the movie.
Right.
I mean, I'll give David O. Selznick and MGM some credit here, is that they really did try and tamp down on. And one of the things Hattie McDaniel insisted on in the role was that they never say the N-word in the movie. Of course, they called them all darkies all throughout the movie, but whatever. I mean, she fought for that and she got it, and that should be recognized. I don't think Gone with the Wind should be put on a shelf. I don't even think Song of the South should be put on a shelf. I think these things need to come out to be discussed so that we can see how we saw our own history.
Right. I'll give you an example. TCM has a very, forgive me for not, I don't remember the name of it, but they're showing it every now and then. TCM has a very good documentary about blackface.
Right.
And it's beautiful, because the whole point of the documentary is to show that you need to see these things. You should embrace them or even think they're okay, but you need to see them so that you don't repeat history. If you don't know history, you aren't able to make a decision that those things shouldn't exist anymore. It shouldn't be repeated. You really need to know your history. That's my
point. And when you say history, what we're saying here is, you know, you don't watch Gone with the Wind to understand the history of the Civil War. You watch Gone with the Wind to understand how America saw the Civil War for most of its history after the Civil War.
Right.
And how it's the depiction of the Civil War and of the antebellum South in that movie was never a realistic or a historically based depiction of it. And so you need to have that discussion about why does Scarlett O'Hara have to be so drop-dead beautiful, you know, like this perfectly lily-white, drop-dead beautiful heroine in these perfect, perfect dresses? And you have to ask, why, how come the slaves all seem fine with their slavery in this movie? And what does it say about the mammy figure in history, in our popular entertainment? What does it say that the mammy figure is always this figure that is allowed to talk back to white people? It's the only black figure in you know, old Hollywood who routinely, quote unquote, sassed her employers. You don't see the men do that. The men are all step and fetch it types, but the mammy type was this unusual, like, concession that would voice frustration with the white characters, but never come right out and point out her own exploitation. It's very complicated. And I feel like HBO kind of, screwed this one up by, well, what happened was they pulled it from their streaming platform and they made this announcement. And of course it went political immediately. And I think it was the most streamed movie on every other platform. Like, people were renting it and stuff. Like, that's what happens. But again, it should be noted that HBO was not talking about removing the movie forever and was certainly not taking away anybody else's right to watch it. But it is problematic. It has always been a problematic film, and it continues to be a problematic film. It doesn't mean no one's allowed to watch it. It just means that when we talk about it, we do need to talk about it in context. Similarly to Song of the South, which I never admit this, but people always ask, what's the first movie you remember going to a movie theater? Mine was Song of the South. I don't know if you know the movie. It's the Disney movie slaves. Yeah. And I can't even tell you, all I know is Zippity-Doo-Dah. Like, that's literally all I remember from the film. But, and I've read all the articles about why it was offensive. I'm certainly not suggesting that that movie gets put out in wide release or even that it gets put on a Disney platform. But I think it should be available for study as a film that just...
Did you study these two movies?
In film school, yeah. I mean, and even then, even in the early 90s...
That was going to be my next question.
Yeah, even then it was understood that, well... Song of the South has been packed away since like 1980. Disney won't show it at all. And Gone with the Wind was protested in 1939. People understood that there was, it was widely accepted, but it has always been a protested movie. People understood, especially in the North, that it was romanticizing the South during the war. And when you talk about Gone with the Wind now, this is why I say it's as important to the American culture as the Civil War itself was, is because I think a lot of Southern culture, what we understand as the modern idea of Southern culture, is based on that movie. You know, all the romance, all the Confederate flag, and all of the Lady Antebellum just changed their name, the country music group, this week, which I never, ever, ever could believe that there was a group called right. Lady Antebellum.
We always talked about it every time we put Red Carpet.
Yeah, just together. The romanticizing of slavery right. and of the slavery economy is. And listen, I'm not here to look. Okay, before anybody, any of our Southern listeners get mad at me for this, the North. I mean, all of America has a racist history. I am not suggesting that the South is more racist than the North. But I will say that what is called Southern culture, and there isn't a Northern culture, but there is Southern culture. And a lot of it is based on the South's understanding of itself post-Civil War. And its romanticizing of itself pre-Civil War. So this isn't a criticism of the South. I actually love Southern culture. I love the cooking. I love the music. But I don't love the Confederate flag. And that was my phone. Sorry.
Right. I totally agree. And so it was interesting to see that happening. It's been happening a lot. And my suggestion is do the opposite. Netflix right now has a whole page of movies directed by black.
Yes.
Black women, especially, and black men, and black actors. So just go there, watch these movies.
Or watch Gone with the Wind. You know what? Maybe there's something you heard in this that you never considered before. Go back and watch it with maybe that in mind. Go back and watch it with a critical eye. Take a look at the Mammy character and how she is portrayed and the lines that she's given. And the illusion of her. There's an illusion of independence with a Mammy character. There's just this illusion that, yes, you can order them around, and okay, technically she's a slave, but look, she gets to sass me back all the time. Or if you want to watch it, why is Scarlett O'Hara such a romanticized figure? Partially because it is a romance. I mean, it's like a romance novel with history as a backdrop. Again, look at all of that. Like, why is there an actual love story being placed in front right. of, you know, the greatest
using a anti-slavery war
as
the background for a love story?
Right. So I would never say that, oh, no, don't. You're not allowed to watch it. I would ask or suggest that when you do watch it, question some things and note how much closer it was to the war itself than we ever could be. Like I said, Hattie McDaniel's parents were slaves. And when you watch the film, watch her and question how it must have felt for her to play a role like this.
And it's insane to know that she almost didn't attend the Oscars.
She wasn't allowed to. She wasn't allowed in the Coconut Grove.
That's my point. Yeah.
She did go, but they had to get a special dispensation to allow a black person in.
But it's just crazy that, you know, this woman can't attend the event, but at the same time, they make a movie where they just...
Exactly. So that alone, you should be questioning. I mean, that the movie was made system, in that culture where if an actress was nominated for an Oscar, they had to get special permission for her to attend the Oscars because she was black.
Examine that.
Examine the people who made that film were working in that system. And if that's the world they were in, where black people couldn't use the same water fountains or couldn't sit in the front of the bus.
How can you make a movie like
how
that?
How can you make a movie about mm-hmm. slavery that is in any way, historically accurate look at, or that pays any difference to the perspective of the slave?
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem with Gone with the Wind. It's about the Civil War entirely from the Southern perspective. It's about slavery entirely from the white perspective. So those are our thoughts on an 81-year-old movie. I don't hate it, but I never thought it was. It's not, you know, it's not Citizen Kane, put it that way. It's not even Casablanca. But, some people might consider that.
Don't get me started on Casablanca.
All right. You don't like it.
No,
he can't stand Humphrey Bogart.
All right.
Go, Andre Leon Talley. That's the next one.
So the next thing,
Anna Wintour. I'll just because you're bad at setting the table. You are.
Am I? Okay.
You're good at clearing the dishes, but you're not good at setting the table.
All right.
Anna Wintour came out with an apology on behalf of her 30 frickin' years as the head of Vogue and how it has fallen down in, you know, representing Black people or in employing people of color or being equitable in the way it covers these things or, you know, open in the way it covers these things. This was met with a lot of pushback because Anna Wintour is probably the last person in the world who can ride out this moment with an apology. I'll just say quickly here, you and I have always had the utmost respect for her as an editor. She is an extremely talented, and for anyone to remain in her position for as long as she has, to be as influential as she has, you've got to be good at your job. Having said that, she has also spent her entire career pushing what Andre Leontali called a colonialist point of view in her... Vogue is nothing if not elitist. And in America, and even in Europe, elitist almost always translates as white. So it has been an overwhelmingly white publication that overwhelmingly favored the 1% or a lifestyle like that, and which meant it was not a publication where... a lot of BIPOC writers could, you know, express themselves freely. So go, Lorenzo.
Well, the fashion industry in general, when it comes to Black representation, they're horrible. They're absolutely horrible. Even if you have models going down the runway and, you know, you have all these designers loving, you know, Black models and they love to have them going down the runway. These same designers are not necessarily targeting the Black community in terms of what they design.
Right.
That's number one right there. So there's this idea that, you know, the fashion represents everybody, but it's completely not true. And magazines especially, no, absolutely not. And a magazine like Vogue, for example, no, they barely have any Black people employed working in the office. They just don't. They just don't in general. So if you open the magazines, it's the same thing. It's a representation of what the environment that you work in, you know, is all about. So you don't see Black people represented.
Right.
And I remember watching the September issue and feeling very, very uncomfortable with the way that Anna Wintour was treating Edwin Aninfo at the time.
Mm-hmm.
He was working at Vogue at the time. I forget what his position was. One of the editors, I believe. But it was just uncomfortable the way they were talking, how condescending she was, and just being herself, the queen, as she always does. And it just didn't sit well with me,
right,
watching that.
Right.
That's why when he became the editor-in-chief of British Vogue, I thought it was awesome. It was like, well, you know, F you, Anna Wintour, number one. And number two, I was just happy to see a Black person being the editor of a magazine.
And British Vogue is so much better than American Vogue right now.
So, yes, because the person they had before was absolutely awful when it comes to representation.
Right.
You do have magazines like Vogue Italia, for example, a little more open to the idea of including Black people in the magazine. But
not Italia, Vogue Paris, not the Italian
Vogue Italia or some European Vogues, they tend to do these all Black issues, which I always roll my eyes every time they do these things because it's just a one-time thing.
Right.
You know, we're just going to have this whole magazine full of Black people and we're never going to talk about them again. That's the type of approach. And it drives me insane because it's just a publicity stunt. It goes nowhere and they're back to white people again in the next issue. So because we are in the situation we are right now where everybody feels that they have to speak in favor of Black Lives Matter, and I'm not saying this is wrong, but it's just interesting to see who is actually doing it.
Right.
Sometimes people who never said anything before, but they feel the need to say it now, which maybe is an improvement. I'm not saying this is wrong, but
right,
when you know their history a little, you can't help but, you know, roll your eyes a little.
Right, right, right.
So that's what happened with Anna Wintour. The thing is that Andrea Leontali has a new book out, a biography, I believe, called The Chiffon Trenches, which is very good, by the way. He also has a documentary film. I think he released a film before he released the book. And they're both great. I actually admire him a lot. Yes, he's flawed, like, you know, everybody in the fashion industry, but he is his story is very interesting. He's a poor guy, African-American guy, gay, you know,
right.
All these things going against him. And he fought very hard because he loved fashion and he wanted to be in the fashion industry. And he is one of the biggest names in the fashion world and history.
I mean,
so yeah, he achieved a lot and I do like him and he really knows fashion. So I admire him. But now because he, you know, is trying to sell a book, so he's doing all these interviews and stuff. And he was interviewed and asked about Anna Wintour's, what happened was Anna Wintour came out with a statement saying that she regrets the way the magazine has always approached minorities and that she...
Bear in mind, she's been in charge, the top woman. Right. She could have changed any of this at any time in the last 30 years.
Not only that, she's not just now Vogue... she's pretty much Condé Nast the whole empire. So she could have done something.
And under the Condé Nast umbrella, Bon Appetit is currently going through its own implosion because its own editor was racist.
Bingo. That's exactly what it is. You
know, these magazines are so elitist in the lifestyle that they're promoting that they can't even imagine hiring anybody but white people to help them promote it.
Well, that's the thing. Magazines are not doing well, number one. And then you have all these scandals coming out, you know, with Bon Appetit and all these people coming out and complaining about racism, in the industry. So of course she came out with a statement saying that she's going to do better. She's going to do more. And she regrets what she's done in the past.
It's empty.
Even though she didn't. And that's what Andrea was saying. Like, yes, you said that you regret what you did, but you're not mentioning anything specifically.
Right, right, right.
You're not detailing anything.
Right, exactly. What did you not do or do
right,
wrong?
Right, exactly.
Anna.
So it's this very broad statement just to, you know, be safe. And that's, he went off on her and complained about her and that she, this is the way she is. And, you know, he knows her. They've worked together for a long time. And, They were friends for a long time, and apparently they're no longer friends. And he always complained. If you remember, if you watch the September issue, you might remember a scene where he's playing tennis. Andre is playing tennis, and he says he's playing tennis because Anna Wintour was complaining that he was fat, pretty much.
Right.
So she suggested that he plays tennis to lose weight. She's obsessed with weight, and she's always fat shaming people.
Right.
I mean, she's done it a couple of times, you know. So it's interesting how this whole thing with Anna Wintour and Vogue and Andre, I just thought it was fascinating. But again,
it's happening all over. It's just happening
all over
publishing, all over media, all over the celebrity complex, is that people are badly stepping up. And in the case of Anna Wintour, it's more like, I don't think there's anything you could say, Anna. You've been in charge for 30 years.
Right.
The magazine is well known for being very elitist, very white-based, and at times over its recent history, absolutely racist. So it's, like I said, I've always admired Anna as an editor. And I think in a few times on this very podcast, I've kind of come out against the idea of forcing her to step down because of how much she's accomplished. But after this, after she did, and I don't mean this like we need to punish Anna for not giving out the right apology. It's more like, God, you're so not right for this time anymore. You're just not right to be heading up this magazine. And nobody proved that better than Edward Enninful when he took over British Vogue from another clueless white lady.
Right. The bottom line is that if you're not obsessed with fashion like I am, name black models, aside from Naomi Campo. Name one. A designer. Famous, very famous designer. I mean, very, very few. That's how the industry has been for decades. So they talk a little when things get a little, you know, hot.
Right.
But then they just move on to something else. And I do hope that things change a little this time.
I do want to get in here and say that we have been... past several podcasts and on our social media, I guess doing our part as cultural critics, and we've been calling out a lot of this sort of behavior, but I don't want to position myself as the ultimate woke white person.
No,
you know what I mean?
No.
Like, anything I know or understand about what's right and wrong about these reactions is something I had to learn by making those mistakes myself.
Right.
Number one. Number two, I can honestly say I am constantly checking myself. And again, so I don't sound like I'm patting myself on the back, I check myself and find things. It's not like, oh, I'm checking myself and I'm perfectly free and clear of anything that might be, you know, racist in my thinking or in my, you know, whatever. No, I check myself all the time and more so lately. We're not holding ourselves up as the ultimate white allies. We have done performative allyship in the past. We're trying to make sure we're not doing it now. I don't want anyone to think that we feel like, you know, if everyone just did it the way Tom Lorenzo did it, all white people would be fine. It's not the case.
And the bottom line is that I'm just stating here things that I have observed. Black people should be the ones judging if the white people are doing a good job or not. Not me.
Right. True. And getting away from that, I just wanted to touch on the one final bit of a famous person sticking their foot in their mouth this week, which is Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling decided, you know what?
Oh, dear.
I want everyone paying attention to me instead of racism or a worldwide pandemic. So for whatever reason, she went off. Well, she saw an article where the phrase people who menstruate was used instead of just saying women, because, you know, not everyone who menstruates is a woman, you know, in our understanding now, but she will not accept that at all. And she went off on a tirade, and this was on social media. And then, you know, she got a lot of outcry. So then a day or two later, she posted this long letter on her, and God, the letter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I read that letter and I was like, wow. The number of times she refers to trans women as men or just men in dresses.
And she goes back
like an absolute refusal to accept trans identity at all. And it's all, this was the part that, I mean, I know what TERFs are. I've read up on them, but I never really had to deal with TERFs in my, I mean, they're not part of our readership or anything like that. But pardon me, it was actually Lorenzo, by the way, all those really angry tweets on social media. That was him getting righteous on her ass.
That's why I put an L at the end of my tweet.
So that got a lot of, they wound up in a moment. They get put in a Twitter moment and then all these crazies come. So all these TERFs wound up in our mentions. And I was like, wow, they really just twist the whole thing around. So it's not about transphobia and not recognizing trans identities. It's about misogyny and about men attacking women. Because in their minds, trans women are just men who want to use their bathroom. I mean, she has come out and said it.
Yes.
And all the responses that we were getting in our mentions was the same thing. But it was clothed or couched in this, you know, very upper class white feminism, which, I mean, the word mansplaining kept getting thrown at us. And it's like, you don't get to come into my mentions and tell me I'm mansplaining. I'm not mansplaining anything to you. And calling us testicle havers. They're really obsessed with genitals, these ladies. And that we need to sit down and shut up and stop attacking J.K. Rowling, stop attacking women, and one asked us to stop attacking her gay daughters. It's...
What?
These TERFs, the whole thing is based on...
See, I didn't read any of them.
This weird... I don't know. Again, I'm not here to tell women how to be feminists. It's not my place, but... TERF feminism is based on this idea of women just being complete and utter victims, and white women being complete and utter victims in society, and no trans person could ever understand the hardships that a woman has to face. And listen, we have spent most of the last 10 years of our blogging career addressing these issues of, you know, misogyny or sexism in the entertainment industry and in culture. No one's denying that those things are true, but they don't give you a right to deny other people's identities.
Here's the thing. The reason why I got so annoyed with it is that because, first of all, this woman is very, very intelligent, number one.
Very powerful with an enormous platform.
Well, that's the other part. But first of all, she's very, very intelligent. She knows exactly what she was doing from the beginning. Used a word she knew she would trigger a lot of things. So she knew. She knew exactly what she was doing. And then... she thought she was going to get a lot of support from, you know, powerful people just like her. And here's the thing. This is such a time now when we're talking about racism and hatred and all these things. You know, we're trying very hard here to focus on these things. And then here comes this person very powerful, with a ton of followers, money.
A ton of influence.
Influence, money, privilege, you name it. And then decided to shift the conversation to something, to phobia.
Right. Transphobia.
Transphobia in this case. So it's just bad. Not that there's a right time to do it, but it, right now is just not the time.
Right.
But she didn't care. And then she didn't get the attention, didn't get the support she thought she was going to get.
She was attacked, according to her. She was attacked for being a woman.
So she was... that wasn't enough, so she wrote this very long letter and posted on her site. Now, the thing is that she posted on her Twitter account and closed the comment section.
Yeah.
So, there you go. Number one, you really don't want a conversation. You just want to expand on your transphobia.
Right.
So, I went and read to her site and read the letter, and I couldn't believe, first of all, I couldn't believe how everything was calculated, every word, everything she was saying. But at the same time, she was all over the place. Like, sometimes she would say, you know, I love transgender women. I know, I love transgender people. As a woman... And then she would go on and on and on. Or sometimes she'd say, you know, I love transgender women. It's like all over the place. She doesn't even know. Except, and she confuses sex with gender all the time.
Not only that, but she, the whole TERF argument rests on the assumption that to be transgender is to be a male to female transgender. So cis men need to shut up.
She focused on that, yeah.
And I'm like, everything you think you're feeling as a woman when you look at trans women, well, I gotta say, as a cis man, I had to work my way through those feelings as well when I came to an understanding of what trans
right.
people were. So I'm not outside this conversation. That is such a narrow-minded way of thinking of it. And of course, it denies that there is kinship between gay people and trans people. The reason we were defending, you know, we were going after J.K. Rowling was because transphobia is a form of homophobia. It's all part of the same thing.
I mean, the thing she said, because it's very long.
It's a variant on homophobia. I shouldn't say that.
It's very, very long. She talks about, like, how are we going to have sex now if we don't know if you're a man or woman? That's pretty much the...
That is the dumbest goddamn thing.
Yes, and listen, it's so dumb. Yes, maybe we need to look at people in a different way, if you know, when it comes to our sex desires. I don't know.
Well, that's what I was going to lead to, is one of the things when... And listen, anybody over a certain age who is trans supportive had to go through this, because I didn't grow up thinking this way about trans people. I had to work my way through a lot of stuff. And I'll tell you right now, again, so that I don't present myself as this ultimate woke person, some of this stuff I didn't come to an understanding until we were writing our book.
Right, exactly.
In the last 2 years. So, again, I'm not trying to elevate myself as I've known this all along. I didn't. I had to work my way through this. And I remember when Laverne Cox first hit it big. She was the first really big transgender actress in a really long time, and I probably one of the probably the first one to make that kind of that level of a she became a household name. And I remember when she was hitting red carpets, you and I had a discussion about, we were very excited that we were going to get the opportunity to write about a trans entertainer,
right.
Which is kind of quaint now because there's so many of them. But and we had a discussion about what language to use and how to talk about her. And I remember saying to you at the time. After I'd worked my way through it, I was like, there's really only one thing we need to remember when we write about trans women. They're women. They're women. Like, okay, it's,
right.
You can talk about, I mean, if you don't think Laverne Cox had the same experiences as you did growing up, that's as a cisgender woman. Yeah, I mean, that's probably true, but maybe you should expand your idea of what women's experiences are. They're not just you growing up. And certainly the weird obsession with menstruation.
Well, that's the other
because
thing.
I'm sorry. Does this mean every woman who goes through menopause is less of a woman? Does this mean women who have hysterectomies are less than women, or women who have menstrual issues is their womanhood somehow on the line? Because that's not the definition of a woman. Someone who menstruates.
The what I take from the whole thing is A, that she's a very insecure person.
Yeah.
It comes across as someone very insecure, very unsure about a lot of things. And, you know, maybe that's how you grew up. That's how you are. And it's not my place to judge. But as a powerful person with a voice,
it behooves you to read up on this stuff.
Right. She said, and that's the alarming part, that she said that, I quote her here, I've spent the last 3 years obsessively reading about transgender people.
Yeah, reading TERFs.
So I was like, okay.
Did you read anything by a trans person?
So, red flag right there.
Right.
If you spent the last 3 years reading about it, and this is what you have to say, it is alarming. Anyway, I was very disappointed with the replies she got, because there's a lot of people defending her.
Of course.
And it just made me very sad.
And couching it in feminism.
Made me very sad. Yeah. The whole thing made me very sad. She knew exactly what she was doing. And now, the Sun paper in
yeah, we should mention.
I do want to mention this
that,
because.
Okay. The Sun published, because she, J.K. Rowling mentioned in her letter that she, her first husband, that she was a survivor of domestic abuse. So The Sun, because UK tabloid media is scummy, not even funny.
Horrible.
They got a hold of the guy, and he wrote about how he used to hit her and he doesn't regret it. It was on the front page of The Sun
today.
It was
awful, awful.
So let me just say right here, that is disgusting.
Yes.
I wouldn't wish that on anyone, and I certainly don't think it was the right thing to do to her. And what sucks about it is it's just going to she's going to dig her heels in more, because now she is getting attacked as a woman. She's not getting attacked by trans people. She's getting attacked by the media.
And by a straight man.
Right. But she will conflate it with trans. And that's
right,
the other
right.
thing. The way she talks about trans people, about how scary they are and how threatening they are to her and how they're going to attack her. And, you know, that is grotesque in a world where violence against trans people is such an epidemic. You can't even point to that many news stories of trans people actually being violent.
But at the same time, she says she loves transgender people, and
she loves them in their little boxes, so long as they don't try and claim to be women.
And she knows many of them. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah. My best friends, all my friends are gay. All my friends are black.
Anyway,
whatever.
I tweeted about it because I was very angry that someone was using their platform to just, you know, expand on hatred, especially
now. I agree. Bottom line, trans women are women, trans men are men, and being a man doesn't mean having a penis, and being a woman doesn't mean menstruating, and we should be well past these ideas now. The experiences of cisgender women growing up are defining experiences for womanhood, but you behooves you, just as we have had to do with cis gay men, to expand our understanding of what masculinity is
right.
and what constitutes manhood. And ultimately, it comes down to, if you say you're a man, you're a man. If you say you're a woman, you're a woman. I do not have the right to argue with you on such a basic understanding of your own identity. That's it. That's the bottom line.
It's a learning
process.
If
you look at a trans, if you're a woman and you look at a trans woman and say, okay, but her life was nothing like mine. Okay, but that doesn't mean her life, that doesn't make her not a woman. Your life is not the only defining, you know, just like our lives were not the only way to define manhood. That's the point. And, you know, one of the things that I really, really solidified for me in the writing of our book, because I was always trans supportive, but like a lot of gay men, I had a hard time understanding why we were supposed to see ourselves as under the same umbrella as trans
right.
people. Not because I thought they were freaks or anything like that, but I was like, well, their experiences are so different from mine. Like, what's the connecting, aside from, you know, going against gender expectations, what is the connecting tissue between gay people and trans people? And then, of course, we did all this research on our book, and I hope you've read it. And it's not just that trans people and gay people have stood side by side in their battles through most of their battling, but that when you read the accounts of trans people coming to terms with their transness, it's exactly the same. I mean, the end result is different, but the way they talk about their process of self-acceptance and then coming out, it never sounds any different to me than the process most gay people go through when they come into self-acceptance and come out. Like I said, what they accept about themselves is different in the end.
Mm-hmm.
To be gay is not, you know, it doesn't go hand in hand with being trans and vice versa. But there is a similarity of experiences and definitely a long history of our groups together. So that's it. That's all. I mean, here's Tilo tackling racism and transphobia. And
I know.
I hope, again, we're not the experts. We're just working our way through this stuff like anybody else. And we would urge all white people, all allies of trans people, to never stop doing that work. That literally was the point of that stupid celebrity video, is that we are supposed to do the work. And the work is ongoing, and the work never ends. And it's called work for a reason, because it's hard. And you can take the easy route like J.K. Rowling, or you can work your way through this stuff. That's it. That's the end. Let's end on a happy note. It's Pride Month.
Yes, yes.
Yay! And we got a great review from our on our book from the San Francisco Book Review this week.
So thank
you. Says it first off, it's so great to be getting reviews 3 months after publication. It's a freaking 5-star review, which is lovely. And it's one of those reviews I love because it said something that literally was in our minds when we were writing the book. Like, it was one of the things we wanted people to say about the book, which was, it's the kind of book you can pick up, laugh a little, cry a little, nod your head, and then put down and come back to later.
Right.
It was written that way. It's not a novel. You're not supposed to read through it in one sitting. You're supposed to put it down and think about it and then come back to it. It was literally written that way. So it was very exciting to hear that. Anyway, I'm rambling. Kittens, love you for sticking with us through this time when we are struggling like everybody else, and we thank you for that.
We appreciate it very much.
We're just going to keep on trying to do our best to provide you with entertaining or thought-provoking content. There's way more costume design posts in the pipeline, so don't worry about that. Anyway, until next week, love you, mean it. Bye-bye.
Love you, bye.